At this time, John and Dick begin the technical net, which meets most Sunday evenings to discuss our favorite subject, ham radio, radio wireless, how the hardware works, how radio waves propagate, how antennas work, and so on, transmission lines. And this is TechNet number 1439 of the series that began 30 years ago. September of 1982 is when the TechNet was born. Hard to believe that it's lasted this long. At the time, me and my partner thought that we would answer everybody's questions in a couple of weeks and dry up and go away. Well, we soon realized there's a real thirst for knowledge on this subject. The schools do a mediocre job, the books do a mediocre job of explaining how it works, how to understand it, and so on. Amateurs are very good at teaching each other. We communicate. It's the main thing hams do. Whether it's international, domestic, or whatever, we communicate. Let me drop. So in the tri-state area, there's a lot of brain power that we try to tap into, that the TechNet tries to tap into. So when a person hears a subject being discussed that he has something to say about it, he's got previous experience, we hope he'll chime in and give us the benefit of his previous experience and his knowledge. That's how it works. For those who don't have a ham license yet, they send a email message or a snail mail message to John, KC2WGB, and by that means, by his mailbag, their questions get asked. Ordinarily, the TechNet is only a live question and answer period. John and I are not proposing to give free consulting service during the rest of the week, even though lots of people are asking for that from time to time. We can't. That's beyond the call of duty. The TechNet, as it is, usually lasts 4 hours. We start at 8 o'clock, and we usually end at midnight, 4 hours later, each Sunday night. The total number of hours that the TechNet has been on the air is greater than the total number of hours that Johnny Carson is on the air with his 30 years of the Tonight Show. Let me drop. By some of the questions I heard being discussed during the week where people said, hey, I'm going to bring that up on the TechNet, I think we might get into the discussion of what happens when you put multiple antennas together, not using just one antenna on your transmitter, but use two or three antennas at once. What's the advantage and disadvantage? How does that all work? Heard another discussion where someone said, we'll discuss it on the TechNet. He has one of these wind-up emergency radios. And instead of charging a battery when you wind it up, it's charging a supercapacitor. Why do they use a capacitor instead of a battery? These are some of the subjects that might get discussed tonight. The majority of what's discussed during the first hour is primarily ham radio-like subjects. John and I try to make a promise that during the first hour we give people at least a brief answer to their question, so that in theory a person doesn't have to wait for more than an hour to get at least a brief answer. After that first hour, hour and a half, when we try to answer everyone's questions who sign in the order in which they sign in, then Paul, WS2N, tells us what's going on in space, and John goes to the mailbag and reads one, two, three, or four of the mail-ins that he's had from people who don't yet have their ham license. That's the usual schedule. Beyond that, we get into deeper subjects to go on for the next 2 or 3 hours, and some of those subjects in the past have been my questioning with the give and take that I've had with Greg, KC2QIQ, as to what does a radio wave really consist of. I said Greg, I meant Glenn. KC2QIQ has a lot of magnetic experience. I believe that an awful lot of what a radio wave is primarily magnetic, and I'm questioning how much electronic is to that wave, where it doesn't consist of conducting plates and any charged particles. Another thing that we can discuss is that I believe a good number of the drownings that occurred during Hurricane Sandy were really electrocutions.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Really electrocutions, because those people were putting their body in salt water, an extremely conductive substance. At the same time, the salt water is eventually touching an electrical outlet. And if within a quarter of a mile of where you are, the salt water is touching an electrical outlet and you're in that salt water, you're in a lot of trouble. You don't want to be there. I know there's no easy way to redo those 120 people who supposedly drowned to find out was it electrocution versus drowning. But if it was, if that's possible, that would be a good piece of information to have, because I think the public there does not have enough information. The smarter companies like Con Edison and Long Island Power Authority, when they see salt water pouring into a community, usually will pull the plug. And are they doing it to save the damage to their equipment or to save lives? I hope the answer is both and yes. And one other subject worth discussing is the Percy Spencer urban legend, I'm calling it, that he invented the microwave oven by having a chocolate bar in his pocket that melted when he was working near a magnetron or a klystron microwave tube. I've recently made some measurements that I think shoot some pretty big holes in that story. We may get to that. So, as you can tell, there's a lot of subjects to be discussed. So, a person signs into the TechNet. Let me drop. Person signs into the TechNet by giving John and Dick first your call letters, second your name, and third the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. You need that sign in just because you're listening. After 30 years and the TechNet still exists, we believe somebody in the tri-state area is listening, and by way of IRLP and Echolink, people from the much further away areas are also signing into the TechNet. One other thing worth discussing is that you will be hearing jamming from time to time. The TechNet has experienced quite a bit of that recently. A special website has been set up by the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club, LIMARC, and that is rfi@limarc.org. So if you will document by using the reverse button on your radio how strong is the jamming when you hear it, carefully document also the time that you heard it. So you heard what jamming at what time, and give that information to rfi@limarc.org. We'll really appreciate that. Be a little bit careful on the timing of the reports we've been getting. Sometimes people are not indicating when they heard it. The most valuable, let me drop. There's two different kinds of jamming that are going on in the New York City area. One is mobile, and the other is fixed. The mobile stations, by way of reporting their signal strength versus time, a pattern can be derived, which indicates some of the routes that are being taken by the mobile jammers. But the most valuable one is the fixed one. Now, not many people have done that by practice, but if you do practice pressing the reverse button on your FM transceiver, which means you're now listening to the input frequency, and if you can record the signal strength that you hear and the time accurately and report it to RFI at limarc.org, that would be very much appreciated. However, the main fixed station that we're looking for is the one that puts out a weak signal, and for those who are lucky enough to own an all-mode rig, like my Kenwood TS-711. When I put it into the Morse code encryption, the single sideband mode, CW or single sideband mode, and listen for the carrier of the weak signal, listen for the tone and the noise. It takes practice to do that, because when you simply hit the reverse button, if yours is an all-mode rig, in other words, the one that has both FM and single sideband, when you simply hit the reverse button, normally it will not allow you to do any further tuning of the main frequency dial until you go back out of the reverse mode. You have to go into memory mode, in other words, the VFO mode. In the VFO mode of the A or B VFO on a rig like that, you can now tune slowly up and down in frequency when you're in the single sideband mode, listening for a weak signal on the input. That information is valuable because the main fixed guy we're looking for, he intentionally makes himself very hard to find by using 1 milliwatt of power, minus 30 dBm, using 1 milliwatt of power. Therefore, you can hear him in the sideband mode and therefore report the signal strength, whereas in the FM mode, you might not be able to hear him and you think he's not there. Those are the more valuable reports. If we can get those, with a little bit of practice with your all-mode rig, you could give us that information. It would be very much appreciated. Okay, at this time we're going to take check-ins. Please give me your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment. K2RIW, Romeo, India Whiskey. My name is Dick, and John and I are listening. Go right ahead.
B2HWW, yes.
T1 for PSV, you hear me now. No question.
Yeah, we've got both Howie and Rich. Who else?
No one wants to know, Dennis.
I, Joe with a yes, a second Joe with a no. Okay, who else wants to check in? Give me your call letters and name right now.
Joe was first online, WD2HWW.
Howie, I'm telling you for the third time, you are checked in. Howie, you are checked in. We've got you, Howie. You're number one. Stop worrying. Howie, number one. Joe, number two. Who else is going to check in? Give me your call letters and name right now.
WS2N. Space report.
Okay, Paul's got a space report. Good to hear that. Anyone else to check in? Give me your call letters and name right now. One last call. Anyone else to check in? Give me your call letters and name right now. KQLIW.
Yeah,
I'm taking
Jim. I don't know if you're going to have a time to touch the basis of the subject from last week. We didn't discuss that the levitation of the materials that is paramagnetic.
Very fine, Wes. We're not going to be discussing that during the first hour, but after that, I think we'll try to get to that. Okay, Howie, WB2HWW, go ahead with your question, Howie, KQRIW.
K2RIWWB2HWW. Okay, Dick. Just want to say, 30 years, I'm an old man. I was 27 then, or 28 then. A long time ago when you guys were on double O repeat, when you first started on 440-147. Okay, here's the question, Dick. A couple of guys on my repeater who are going camping are looking at the Alex loop. You can go look at this on the internet. It's made overseas. It's a magnetic loop antenna with a tuning. It's about 2 feet in diameter. It goes from 7 megahertz to 30 megahertz. They claim the thing is very efficient. It's almost as efficient as a full-size antenna. And it's meant for portable operation, QRP. Now, I'm not that up-to-date on magnetic antennas, but I felt that magnetic antennas were supposed to be used in very low frequencies where they were one-tenth the wavelength, you know, 0.01 or one-tenth the wavelength. So I'd like to know what you think of the Alex loop and a very small magnetic antennas instead of the conventional, you know, dipole-type antenna. K2RIW, WD2HWW.
Very fine, Howie. And I've got a general answer for this one, which is basically good news. And if you start off as a reference antenna, the most basic and very popular antenna, a half-wave dipole on whatever band you're operating on, at a reasonable altitude, fed with the right kind of transmission line, and maybe with a balancing device right at the antenna, that's the ideal starting point. You read the appropriate chapter of the first edition of the antenna book by Krauss. It's a McGraw-Hill book, published 1950, and to many people it's the Bible on the subject of antennas. And you read the chapter on the infinitesimal dipole, and you'll find out that as you make a dipole shorter and shorter in physical length, but reestablished electronic resonance by way of loading coils, top hat capacitors, helical winding of the radiator section, curving it around, zigzagging, and even curving it around into a circle. No matter what you do to make the antenna physically smaller, if you're using low-loss materials and you're smart enough to reestablish resonance, you come back to the exact same efficiency on both transmit and receive. The hard part to believe in that environment is that as the antenna becomes physically smaller, how in the world can it have the exact same amount of effective capture area when you're receiving? That's the hard part to believe. That's the magic of resonance. As the antenna gets smaller and smaller, the Q gets higher and higher. Let me drop for a second. The Q gets higher and higher. That means the antenna becomes more and more narrowband as you make it smaller and smaller physically in length. And whether you wrap it into a circle or whether you use it straight out as a dipole or zigzag it, these are very minor details. You're making the antenna physically smaller, the Q increases. When you're transmitting, a higher Q really means that one of the definitions of Q is the center frequency divided by bandwidth. The bandwidth becomes more and more narrow. The Q number gets higher and higher, 10, 20. 5 to 4.0. Well, dipoles just barely make that. If you make the dipole shorter and shorter, or make it into a small so-called magnetic loop, yeah, maybe you'll only be able to tune 30 kc up and down before you hit a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, and then you got to retune it. Because of that higher Q, that really means you get more and more circulating current in the antenna, it's generating more and more magnetic field, and it still radiates with the exact same efficiency. If you have any doubt about the efficiency of your antenna, let me drop. There's a very simple way you can confirm that. Assuming that you've got, let me pick a number, a 100-watt transmitter, and you run the 100-watt transmitter key down for 60 seconds. Lift up the key, walk over there, and touch the antenna. The only way an antenna can be inefficient is it takes your valuable RF energy and turns it into heat. If it's turning into heat, something's got to get hot. If your antenna is well-tuned and well-matched, so you've got a reasonably low standing wave ratio, that means the radio energy going up that transmission line ain't coming back. It's going to the antenna. If the antenna runs ice cold, that means every bit of it's being radiated into space. It's got no other place to go. Conservation of energy. There's only three things the antenna can do with its energy. Reflect it back to the transmitter, turn it into heat, or radiate it into space. If the VISWR is low and it's running cold, by definition, it is efficient. No matter how small it is, whether it's one turn, a fraction of a turn, of a loop, whether it's a small dipole, zigzags, or whatever. That's the physics of small antennas. You say these words on the 20-meter band on a Saturday afternoon, and a whole lot of people who say, no way, you guys are crazy, and they'll laugh you off the band. These people don't understand real antenna theory. So that's the physics of what you're working with. The fact that it's small doesn't mean anything. The fact that it can tune a whole lot of bands, as long as it has the right kind of tuning control made with low enough loss materials and runs cold to the physical touch when you put power into it. And the VISWR is low enough, and as I said before, by conservation of energy, it's got to be working. Let me drop this one other point here. And that is, depending on how you physically lay out the antenna, when you make it small, does determine the antenna pattern. You've got to worry a little bit about at this particular day and that particular guy you want to talk to. Do you have the right altitude of the antenna so you skip at a low enough angle off to him? And do you have the right polarization? And is the main lobe of the antenna in his direction? If you're trying to talk to a guy in London, the Great Circle Pass between Long Island and London is roughly to the northeast. So is the main lobe of the antenna directed to the northeast? And horizontal or vertical polarization is something else that works pretty well. You have to worry about that a little bit. A really smart guy, because antennas usually don't include very expensive materials, a really smart guy will have both a horizontal and a vertical polarized antenna and a switch in the shack where you can flip back and forth between the two. Depending on the state of the ionosphere, one will work better than the other. Common sense would lead you to believe if that guy you're talking to in London happens to be vertically polarized, you would think that you want to run vertically polarized. Not necessarily so, because you're reflecting that signal off the ionosphere. The ionosphere is a plasma. The plasma has simultaneous magnetic field from the Earth mixed into it. Whenever you've got magnetic field and plasma and a radio signal going through it, you will experience something called Faraday polarization rotation. That's a fancy way of saying you issue a horizontal signal on Long Island, it goes into the atmosphere, twists a couple of times, and it may end up vertical in London, the guy you want to talk to. So if you've got both kinds of antennas and you flip back and forth between the two when you're transmitting and ask your buddy in London which one sounds the loudest to him, that's good information. However, when your guy in London transmits a signal back to you, you have to reflip the switch back and forth between horizontal and vertical because Faraday rotation acts differently going east to west versus west to east, if you know what I mean. It doesn't necessarily obey reciprocity.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
As I said, it doesn't obey reciprocity. Depending on which direction the signal goes through the ionosphere determines something about how many times it rotates in polarization. So I'm going to the Alex Loop antenna. When I get a chance, I'll look it up. But now you know what to look for. You can teach a person to fish or you can teach them how to go fishing. When you teach a person how to go fishing with reference to an antenna, you teach them that small antennas are not bad as long as you've got enough tuning controls, a large enough range of your antenna tuner, and low enough loss feed line. And once you understand the principle, don't be afraid of small portable antennas. With good physics involved, they can give you very high performance, opposite of common sense. I wonder if this is some of the information you're looking for, Howie. If not, ask a little more, because antennas and small antennas are always a good subject to discuss, particularly for people who live in apartments and have to have invisible antennas and put up temporary antennas on the balcony of their apartment and hide them on the roof of the building and whatever. WB2HWW, K2LIW in the TechNet. You got it, Howie.
Yeah, I do know that. That's what I went over with the guys. I know that small antennas can be efficient, but this antenna, I wish you could take a look at it, because this is like a Faraday, it's like a, what do you call, the type of antenna you have a ferrite core inside of an AM radio. It's like a loop antenna, okay, which is basically a magnetic antenna. It's not looking at the H field, it's looking at the magnetic field. Now, this thing actually is like a transformer. There's a primary and a secondary, and in the primary they're using a capacitor. I think the antenna will work. I'm just not sure about the difference between, you know, a magnetic antenna and a standing, you know, an antenna that uses the H field. So that's what I was trying to say, because it'll probably gaze it. I mean, when you get down to, let's say, 160 meters or the AM broadcast band, you're using a ferrite coil, and this thing is almost like a ferrite coil, but it's not. It is basically a loop antenna. It basically works on a magnetic principle. Go ahead, Dick. It would be good if you could just take a quick look at it so you could make any comments on it, on the way it's set up with the tuning capacitor, K2RIW, WB2HWW.
Yeah, you think, Howie, and you've fallen into a little bit of a trap, an advertising trap. You assume that there's something between a difference between a magnetic antenna and an electromagnetic antenna or whatever, a traveling wave antenna or a standing wave antenna. Every antenna is a magnetic antenna. That straight, flat-out piece of wire of a half-wave dipole, the majority of what it does, because it has a Q of 10, that means the current rise is 10 to 1 somewhere in the antenna. Whatever current your transmission line launches onto the antenna means that somewhere in the antenna the current is 10 times larger than what you launched. And somewhere else in the antenna the voltage is 10 times higher. Q has many definitions. One of them is the current rise at resonance. Another is the voltage rise at resonance. So somewhere in the antenna of your dipole, the current is 10 times higher than you think it is. That's making magnetic field 10 times higher. That's why you resonate an antenna in order to radiate. A flat-out dipole is a magnetic antenna. The fact that you've taken the wire of the dipole and curved it around into a circle doesn't mean it suddenly went from an electrostatic antenna to a magnetic antenna. It was always a magnetic antenna. That's just advertising hyperbole. It makes it sound like it's something exotic and new. There have been loop antennas. The very first antenna built by Heinrich Hertz was a loop antenna. He had a loop of wire. He was launching current into it in a discontinuous manner. He had another loop nearby, and his detector in those days was spark. He looked at the spark across the gap of the second antenna. The first antenna was sort of like a primary of a transformer, and the second one was the spark that did the receiving. And as he perfected the system, he could make the distance between the two greater and greater. He soon discovered the receiving antenna didn't have to be a loop. It could be a straight-out piece of dipole, except that he didn't have the gap anymore where...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
The only reason he was using a loop instead of a straight-out dipole is that he needed the gap that he could see where a spark jumped across it, and he knew reception was being taken place. So all antennas are magnetic. And what the... If you've been listening to these discussions that Glenn and I have been having, KC2QIQ, I am advocating that the majority of what gets radiated by a transmitting antenna is primarily a changing magnetic field. Every antenna is magnetic. So don't let that advertising hyperbole lead you to believe there's something new. In the case of the ferrite loop antenna that's on your small transistorized AM radio, that ferrite loop is something that where the ferrite has a mu of 10 or 100, mu of 10 or 100 in the magnetic material simply means the magnetic field flows through that material 10 or 100 times better than it flows through air. That's a fancy way of saying you take a few turns of wire around it. Whatever you think is the inductance of those turns of wire just got multiplied by 10 times or 100 times because of ferrite rod. That means it's easier to establish resonance with a smaller number of turns in a small package. On top of that, the ferrite rod does concentrate the local magnetic field when it's doing reception. Let me drop. And therefore, that plus resonance is part of the mechanism by which it establishes a large, effective capture area and gives you good receiving. So if they could make ferrite material have high enough performance at 144 megacycles, and that's very difficult, but if they could, you and I could use a ferrite rod antenna at 144 megacycles, and as long as the amount of transmitter power we're using and the particular ferrite material didn't hit saturation, you and I could build very small, high-performance antennas with a ferrite rod at 144 megacycles or on 450 megacycles. The only reason we don't do it is the ferrite starts becoming pretty lossy at those higher frequencies. But antenna-wise, the concept would work like a charm. And if sometime in the future somebody comes up with a better making of nanoparticles of the ferrite material, which has less eddy current, and therefore the ferrite material runs at higher and higher frequencies, I suspect you will see ferrite antennas at 144 megacycles sometime in the future, if they don't already exist, if you know what I mean. So an awful lot of what looks like brand new concept and brand new breakthrough and brand new advertising and a brand new product is really a rehash of the exact same physics, if you know what I mean. There's no real magic here from my point of view. Let me drop one more time. And when it comes to loop antennas, like for instance the 6-meter hula hoop, which was very popular in the late 50s and early 60s, where sometimes you have a small loop which looks like a primary that does the launching and a larger loop which does the radiating. That's just the feeding mechanism. Whether you feed your loop antenna with a gamma rod, a T-match, directly fed, dipole light, delta match, and whatever, there's a zillion ways of feeding an antenna. There's a zillion ways of establishing an impedance match and or balancing action between your particular transmission line and that antenna. As long as you're using low-loss materials and know what you're doing, physically they look different. They're really the exact same thing. The antenna really is a resonator, very similar to the stored energy you've got in a flywheel. You can decide to feed the flywheel with a push rod that's very close to the pivot, or you can decide to feed it with a push rod that's very close to the perimeter of the flywheel, or anywhere in between. As long as you've got the right kind of impedance match between the piston that's pushing that push rod and the flywheel, it works. Something very similar takes place with your antenna. Your antenna is a high-Q resonating structure. Choose the right feeding mechanism, and they all are capable of giving you high efficiency. No one is better than another, depending on your particular physical layout and your favorite way of doing things and your favorite way of establishing impedance match. You can feed your loop antenna with any of those previous structures that I mentioned, and they all are capable of the exact same efficiency once you know what you're doing. Wonder if this helps, Howie. WB2HWW. Ain't no new magic here, in my opinion. K2RIW in the TechNet.
No, I understand it all. Couple guys are listening, they want to go camping, they want to take this antenna, they're asking me, and I said, I told them that, hey, small antennas doesn't matter if it's resonant. The higher the Q, the narrower your bandwidth, and the more times the signal's got to go back and forth before it launches, like in a dipole. As you always said, it takes about 30 times before the signal launches off the antenna. Okay, Dick, I don't know if you know, it does seem like you've got to look at that antenna. A couple guys wanted to have your opinion on it, because it's an interesting antenna. It only is about 2-3 feet, weighs about a pound, and it's meant for QRP and for mount topping, when you're operating from a mountaintop. Well, thank you so much, Dick. K2RIW, WB2HWW. The antenna's kind of expensive. I just told the guys to make a couple of dipoles, and that would be it, or a couple of NFEDs, but I told them that the small antennas do work, because you got to have a higher Q and that the field is stronger. One thing, the safety. If you ever got to use these small antennas, can't be in the same room with them, because the smaller they get, the higher the field is. in the near field. All right, Dick, thank you so much. K2RAW, WD2HWW. I don't know if you took a look at that while you were talking on the internet.
10 seconds. Howie, when in doubt, you can either speculate, look at the advertisement, try to believe the manufacturer, or you can make a measurement. When in doubt, make the measurement. Put some power into it and see if it runs hot. You'll find out real fast. And you did call it the Alex Loop. If I simply Google Alex Loop, will I find it? Or there's a particular website that you recommend I go to? Over to you, Howie, K2RAW.
Alex Loop, you'll see it right there. It's by an individual. It shows you the guy. Yes, you'll see a whole bunch. Google Alex Loop. It's like the third or fourth one down. Alex Loop, definitely there. And, you know, they also talk about magnetic loops. They go through the whole theory of magnetic loops. I was always under the impression that magnetic loops had to be a very small wavelength, that they worked much better on the low frequencies. That's what I was taught, or that's the theory I understood, that you want them to be a small percentage of the wavelength. Before he passed away, was playing with that antenna on his house. He had that loop antenna that he was using in his shack.
Okay, is the word Alex, A-L-E-X, or A-L-I-X, doesn't matter, one or the other. The reason why you usually make a horizontally polarized loop a small fraction of a wavelength, there's only one reason you do that, to try to get an omnidirectional pattern. An ordinary dipole has the broadside pattern, that in three-dimensional space, it looks like a donut. Let me drop. In three-dimensional space, it looks like a donut, which means if the wire is east-west, you get a stronger signal north-south, and you tend to get a null off the east-west end of the dipole. If you start curving the dipole around into a circle, and it's still a half wavelength long, you get almost the exact same pattern. Off the end, what used to be the ends, you still get a null. As the loop gets smaller and smaller in diameter, and you reestablish resonance, you now have nearly constant current along the whole length of the loop that tends to give you a more omnidirectional pattern. The nulls slowly disappear, and now you're transmitting as much signal north-south as you do east-west. So you're making it smaller in diameter, not to make it magnetic, it always was magnetic, it's just to give it a more omnidirectional pattern. You're sacrificing bandwidth by making it small. It's going higher in Q, but you're doing it to get the more omnidirectional pattern. Again, there's no magic there, if you know what I mean, Howie. So when in doubt, make a measurement. See if it runs cold. If it runs cold, you're home free, and it's got to be high in performance. Okay, Joe is the next guy. W-A-2-R-Y-Y. Over to you, Joe, and how things with you? K-2-R-I-W in the tech net. Has no internal terminating resistor, in which case they do not give you isolation. And they give you a beautiful impedance match, but they do not give isolation. So in some cases, divider and splitter either do or don't have the internal terminating resistor giving you isolation. But if you can put 2 watts into the device, and you get 2 output connectors, and you get very close to 1 watt out of each one of them, it's doing what you want. The next thing you've got to worry about is, why did you want the power splitting? Why did you want the power splitting in the first place? Is it because you're feeding two separate antennas? Say, for instance, you're making a vertically stacked or phased array of two antennas. Then you've got to worry about having the same length of cable going to the two antennas, and you've got to worry about what is the phase difference of your power splitter. If it was a quadrature hybrid, giving you 90 degrees of difference, you might have to readjust one of the cable lengths by 90 degrees, quarter wavelength. If it's a Wilkinson hybrid, then you don't have to do that. Just make sure the two cables are equal in length. A fairly simple measurement. It doesn't necessarily need a network analyzer. There are very simple ways you can find out. If you don't know what's inside the black box, you don't want to open up the cover, you can measure from the outside what is the phase difference. So power dividers, power summers, power splitters, they really are the exact same thing. It's a passive device dividing your power, and they almost always obey reciprocity. If I put 2 watts into the input connector and I get 1 watt out of the 2 output connectors, and now I feed it backwards, I put 1 watt into each of the output connectors, make sure the phasing is right, from the common input connector, I now should get 2 watts out of it. So these are just words as I see it, Joe. There's no real magic there either. Worry a little bit about the internal termination. If I was trying to feed two separate amplifiers, in other words, I've got a single 2 watt driver stage, and I've got 2 high-power amplifiers, and each one to be driven with 1 watt, I would like to be using a power divider that has isolation, a built-in termination, because if any of the reflected power from the input of high-power amplifier number one gets reflected back to the power divider and gets into amplifier number two, you could build up an oscillation. Having isolation there is very handy. Quadrature hybrid, for instance, with the right kind of a terminating resistor, does that, so to speak, automatically.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
So tell us that what was the main reason you're using one of these dividing devices, Joe? And once again, if you're not coming through the machine, not to worry. I hear you very loud on the input, and I'll repeat what you say. W-A-2-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W in the tech net.
Taking transmitters, where the transmitters are actually combined, is using a couple transmitters on the system. And I guess from wherever point they are, but the main purpose is to take the power that's available from, say, a particular transmitter or a particular frequency and divide it so it goes into two different cables that are going in two different directions. Let me just tell you what I know to one of them, because one of them actually says it's a two-way Wilkinson-style power divider. All right, that one is a... made by a company called Microlab. The other one's made by Telewave. All right. I did do a measurement between the two ports, the output ports of the one that's called a Wilkinson divider, Wilkinson star power divider, and there was isolation between the two output ports, looking backwards, using a backwards sort of tracking generator. Now, when I did this measurement, I happened to move the thing and notice that when I moved it, I must have caused some sort of, introduced a sine wave appear on the... She saw it. She took it up on the desk and let it... Yeah, but the sine wave seems to look... That you see a stable, was very small and then very large as it was caught on the screen of the tracking generator. Mike. In a sense, we're using this thing, the possibility of having mechanical vibration coming into this divider itself, would this cause any kind of interruption or problem with the RF energy being radiated? Would you be introducing any type of modulation on your transmitted waveform? Back to you.
Okay, I'm copying everything that Joe's saying on the input. In the case of a Wilkinson hybrid, if you take it apart, you're going to find that the input connector, the common connector, goes to a pair of 70 ohm quarter wavelength long lines, usually Milton strip line, but it could be coaxial cable. That goes to the two output connectors, and between the two output connectors, there's usually a high power ohm resistor. That's where the isolation is coming from. The way you prove isolation is to terminate all the ports properly with 50 ohms, pour some power into output port number one, and the battle power coming out of output power port number two should be 20, 25, 30 dB down. You will have power coming out of the input port number one. That's normal. But isolation means the two output ports are isolated. A properly built Wilkinson hybrid is not mechanically sensitive. If you've got an intermittent contact inside where maybe somebody has put high power into it in an unbalanced manner, overheated the resistor, and one end has unsoldered itself and it's just hanging there just making bare contact, the 100 ohm input terminating resistor, or maybe the strip line that goes to one of the output connectors again is a flaky contact. A properly operated Wilkinson hybrid. You can bounce it on the table, you can give it 50 G's in any particular direction. No change in performance should take place. It's a very stable device, been used for years and years when properly used. So if yours, you move it and something changes, and you shake it and something changes, it's time to take it apart, give it a good physical inspection, Joe. Something is wrong inside, it's been beat up, if you know what I mean. Very similar to the article on directional couplers that's on the microwave website, K5RMG, k5rmg.org, I think it is, the Roadrunners Microwave Group. You go to that particular page, you go to their technical articles, and you go to the bottom of the technical article page, you'll see the K2RIW corner. There you'll find an article by K2RIW about how to use directional couplers to measure standing wave ratio and power and all kinds of things. And there I indicate a calibration procedure where you measure the directivity of your coupler and or its isolation. So the fact that yours is that sensitive mechanically, Joe, means it's time to take it apart and look inside. Don't worry about the fact that you may be going to avoid the warranty. There are guys who own a piece of electronics, they're afraid to take it apart for fear that they'll never get back together correctly, that they'll void the warranty, and sometimes they act like there's a scorpion inside with a year's supply of food. They don't do that, Joe. So it should not be mechanically sensitive, and you shouldn't be having these troubles. And after you investigate it further, you're going to find out what's wrong, you're going to fix it, and you're going to come back and tell us about it, Joe. W-A-2-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W, good question.
Well, I don't know how to physically get the things apart. I can't see how they actually assemble these things. I'm not sure. But these are brand new units in the box. They weren't deployed anywhere. And I took them out of the box from the factory. And the two other devices I tested, which were made by Telewave, I did the same kind of test. Apparently, they're not a Wilkinson type of divider. They're simply a power divider. And they're very, very much, much more narrow in frequency bandwidth. They did not do the same thing at all. They had no effect on the displayed wave on the tracking generator. But I don't know what these things are using, what kind of devices they are internally. But the interesting thing you said about the Wilkinson one is if you had an impedance change on one side, it should not affect the other side, right? Like if you had something happen, like a high visual out of one mode, port, it wouldn't come back and bother the other one too much, or bother it at all. I did see there was about 31 dB isolation between the two ports, the two output ports. I checked it both ways. It was the same in both directions. Back to you.
30 dB of isolation is excellent, Joe. Very good. And by the way, when you move something and it changes, there's always the possibility that one of your three cables was a little bit flaky. connector that's slowly falling apart, or a mechanical fatigue failure of the center conductor of one of the cables. So before you damage your unit and take it apart, when moving it makes a change, make sure you substitute all three cables first and re-establish the measurements. So be suspicious of your cables. Moving an object and having the performance change really means that your cable going to it changed or something internally changed. So you have to reconfirm those things, if you know what I mean, Joe. But moving it should make no difference. 30 dB of isolation on a Wilkinson is great. The ones that don't have an internal termination or an external termination, be a little bit wary of those if you're feeding a pair of amplifiers, particularly if they're solid-state amplifiers. Solid-state amplifiers, the input impedance usually is really flaky. By that I mean it may be a moderately good 1.7-to-1 standing wave ratio at the design frequency, and at all other frequencies, the input impedance of an amplifier could be to hell and gone. It could be a 50-to-1 Vizwar at various phase angles on all other frequencies, and as such, if you hook it up with hybriding or power-dividing devices that don't have isolation, built-in termination somewhere, the possibility exists that the amplifier decides to go to the third harmonic frequency, because it's got a great big reflection on the input at that frequency, reflects power back to the other amplifiers, the two of them talk to each other, and they oscillate like crazy. There's no load at the third harmonic frequency, so to speak, and they sit there and oscillate. So solid-state amplifiers, particularly bipolar amplifiers, fed with power dividers that don't have isolation, your
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
When you do that, non-isolating power dividers into solid-state, particularly bipolar amplifiers, you're sitting on the precipice of disaster, because there's 40 ways that they can find the oscillator, if you know what I mean. Let's see if that helps, Joe. But double-check your cables, because moving it maybe was demonstrating an intermittency of one of the cables and not necessarily the hybrid or power divider or power splitter itself. To B2RYY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick. Well, I use the same test cables on both devices, and one device did not do it, and one device did do it. Actually, say two devices did not do it. I had two of each, brand new in the box I opened up. Two did not do it, and two did do it. And I'm not feeding amplifiers with these devices. They're taking power from a transmitting source, which may have up to three frequencies on it, and they're taking that and dividing that and putting this into radiating cable in a tunnel system. I guess it's called a tunnel DAS, distributed antenna system. So that's, maybe that's the wrong terminology, but they're basically feeding a cable system in tunnels, going in two particular different directions where the transmitter feed is. That's what they're feeding. They're not feeding amplifiers, but I think I actually did change a couple of cables, and the other cables, similar made cables, end-to-end cables, did the same thing. So it made me think that the device itself, even though they're brand new, both devices are doing the same thing. But you're telling me that I should not get any kind of mechanical vibration being introduced to the things that would cause an upset of the waveform itself. Back to you.
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm saying, Joe. Where I ran into this once before, where I had now, supposedly high-quality cable, but when I inspected the cable, I found that the male pin on the type N connector was a little bit more recessed than it was supposed to be. The female pin on the hybrid was a little more recessed than it was supposed to be, and therefore, when I connected those two together, all I had to do is disturb the cable a little bit, and the center conductor was breaking contact on brand A of hybrid, and brand B of hybrid didn't do it. So even a good-looking cable, unless you carefully inspect it for the real amount of penetration, a male and female center pin, that's something to worry about. And when you see this intermittency, when you moved the device, try tilting it, moving it, and then holding it still, and then wiggling the cables by bending them a little bit carefully, whatever. Where moving it made a change. Now start isolating it, twisting it clockwise and counterclockwise, tilting one end up and the other end down. Try to find out what were you physically doing that was making the change. Well, later on, find out what was the nature of the change. Was the Vizwar going from 1-to-1 and jumping up to 3-to-1? But and what did you see? see is a change. I think you said you saw erraticness of the signal output and mechanical vibration. No properly operating power divider of any kind should do that, Joe. I think that's some of what you're looking for. WHYY, K2LIW. Let us know what you find out. Interesting test you got there.
Okay. Well, I'll get into that this coming week, and I will get back to you one way or the other and let you know if what I found as far as anything changed, whatever. Okay, back to you. WHYY.
Are there two different cables that you're feeding in these tunnels in two separate directions? Out of curiosity, Joe, was that Andrew Radiak's cable? In other words, these cables that have got slots along the length that slowly leaks the signal and therefore lights up the whole tunnel. Was that the nature of the cables that you were feeding? And if so, that's an interesting project you're on. Over to you, Joe, K2LIW.
The answer to your question is yes, it's feeding Radiak's type of cable.
Yeah, those are great systems where to make the usual calculations as to how strong the signal strength should be a quarter mile and a half mile down that particular tunnel when you have known amount of signal going into the cable, those can be interesting measurements. And whether or not a person with a handheld transceiver on that train going down that tunnel is going to be getting the kind of coverage he wants, whether it's a cell phone or a handy-talkie for law enforcement or police or fire or emergency and so on. Interesting systems. And we're going to be seeing more and more of those as time goes on because wireless is here to stay. We can't get enough of it. The genie is out of the bottle. Everybody wants complete connectivity 24 hours a day with the thing that's in their pocket, if you know what I mean. We just can't get enough of it. Okay. I think we've gone down the list of people who signed in. Is there anyone else who signed in with a question for the TechNet? If so, if you didn't get a chance to get through, give me your call letters at this time. K2LIW listening.
K2LIW, KB2MER, yes, with a question.
KB2 is a Kilo Bravo 2, Mike Alpha Romeo. And, are you in the Bronx? And, let's see. And tell me your name before you give me your question, but go ahead with your question, sir. K2LIW.
Name here is Gabe, and the call is Kilo Bravo 2 Mike Alpha Romeo. Basically, another question I have, taking into consideration of Howie's question before, I'm just curious, can a antenna be made into a transmitting antenna for some type of HF, let's say maybe 20 meters, for example? How does it have to be above ground if it can be done at all? K2RW, KB2MER, back to net.
Very fine, Jay. We heard everything you said, but there's a catch. The peaks of your voice are over-deviating that particular rig. It jumps out of the repeater, and the repeater goes into the standby mode for a fraction of a second on each one of the peaks of your audio. So you're going to have to someday go to Andy, WA2CDL, at one of the Limark tune clinics and have him reset the deviation control on that rig. For the time being, you better speak a little bit softer into the mic so that we can continuously hear you and you don't jump out of the repeater. Okay, with reference to ferrite rod antenna, yes. Could a ferrite rod antenna on any frequency where it makes a good receiver, would it work as a transmitter? The answer is absolutely yes, and it will work equally well as a transmitter with one big catch, and that is every piece of iron that you and I are ever going to use, whether it's the EI laminations of a power transformer, whether it's a ferrite rod for a transistorized radio receiving antenna, whether it's the tuning, whether it's the magnetics that are inside of a choke for a power supply. Every piece of magnetics made out of metal of some kind has two things in common. Number one, they usually have permeability considerably greater than one. T 10, 5, 15, 30, 100. That really means the magnetic field flows through it that many times better than it flows through air. That's the good news. Let me drop. The bad news is every piece of iron has a specific amount of magnetic field beyond which it saturates. Air as a magnetic field substance device does not saturate. Every piece of iron will saturate at some level. So that ferrite loop stick, depending on the size of the ferrite and the number of turns you've got wrapped onto it, it'll rank a beautiful transmitter, maybe up to the 1 watt level. But you put 10 watts or 100 watts into it and you saturate the iron, and now it's not an antenna anymore. It's a very complicated other thing. So will it work? In theory, absolutely yes. But the next thing you've got to worry about is, are you saturating it because of the particular strength of magnetic field you are demanding because of the number of watts you're putting into it? I wonder if you see the principle on that one, Gabe. KB2, maximum amateur radio, K2RIW. Go ahead, Gabe.
I guess I'll make a really good QRP type of transmitting antenna. Now, as according to the wavelength, does that work the same as a dipole? I'm sorry, I'm talking too close to the mic. According to the wavelength situation, as you would with dipoles, does that ferrite rod antenna have to be a certain height above ground to avoid absorption? Plus, it being such a low power level, you'd want to keep it to a spot where you get very little absorption. Back to you.
Yeah, there's an interesting concept going on here, Gabe, that I'm going to try to make a little bit more clear. Let's assume now that I'm a real enthusiast for 80 meters. And my 80-meter full-length dipole, 132 feet long, happens to be 30 feet in the air because that's the height of the trees that I'm using. When you stand off at a far distance and you make measurements of the signal coming out of that dipole, and you make enough measurements from enough directions and altitudes and whatever, you'll eventually find out that the antenna appears to have... Let's see, I've got something turned on here that's feeding back to me. What in the world is it? Maybe it's my imagination. I think I know what it is. Let's see, it could be that particular rig. Every antenna has what's called an electronic phase center. You stand off at a long enough distance, even though the antenna is 132 feet long and it's 30 feet in the air, it appears that all of the signal is coming from one particular point in space. And whether that point in space happens to be the center of your full-length dipole, whether it happens to be the center of your full-length dipole or the center of a ferrite loop rod that's at that particular location, that's the way it acts. The only thing else you've got to worry about is for that particular altitude and that particular polarization, is it radiating the signal in the direction you care about? And the height of the signal above ground is the primary determining factor for what is the elevation angle that you're radiating. Because that ground you look at, you think it's dirt and grass and your wife's garden, if you know what I mean. To a radio wave, most of the time, that thing you and I call Earth is a mirror. You have a real dipole above ground. You have a mirror image of that dipole below ground. And those two signals beat against each other. And as they beat against each other, you would like, in the ideal world, all of the signals to go straight out to the horizon from your location. KGR, are you here? You would like that signal to go straight out to the horizon and at a low angle. Well, the horizontal polarization, what happens is the signal reflecting off the ground experiences 180 degrees of phase reversal. The signal radiating straight into space doesn't, and that gives you a null on the horizon, and depending on your altitude above ground, the signal is being radiated 30 degrees up in elevation, if you know what I mean. You get the best long distance when you've got a great angle of the signal hitting the ionosphere, the lowest angle as possible. Vertical polarization is less of that. So whether your antenna is big or small doesn't matter. It has an electronic phase center somewhere, and